Hi, this is Steve Roost, and you're listening to Health Tech Hour on UK Health Radio. Each week, we give you the best news, views, and interviews from the health technology world. From CEOs and founders to entrepreneurs and clinicians. The companies and people that are shaping the future face of healthcare. All on the world's number one talk health radio. Hello and welcome to this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost. Each week, we bring you the best news, views and interviews with the leaders, clinicians, CEOs, founders, politicians we have often had on who are changing the face of healthcare today and tomorrow in the UK and beyond. As regular listeners know, I am a CEO and co-founder of a health tech venture myself, which is called PocDoc. PocDoc has launched what is now fast becoming the UK's leading home health check called the Healthy Heart Check. It delivers the equivalent of the NHS health check in just 9 minutes using your phone. It's available in all of the online and high street retailers. If you'd like to know more, head to pocdoc.co. And last week, actually, we launched our new product, Diabetes Health Check, which actually is the world first smartphone-based diabetes health check. So anyway, if you'd like to check out more information about PocDoc, it's pocdoc.co. And thank you, as ever, for PocDoc for supporting the show. So I'd like to say now thank you, as ever, to everyone who's listening live on the amazing UK Health Radio. We love UK Health Radio. It's a great platform. Listen to all the other shows, please. There's some incredible presenters doing incredible things. We really appreciate being on here. Thank you if you are listening on demand on the podcast channel of your choice. We now get downloads in over 50 countries every single month, which is completely wild. Thank you, everybody, for downloading. We must be doing something right. Thank you also if you're watching this, or hello, rather, if you're watching this on YouTube, or if you're watching any of the clips, the best clips. We take the best clips of the show and we put them out on my Instagram, which is at Steve Roost. So like, follow, share. It's greatly appreciated. On last week's show, we had Dan Vedat, who is the CEO and founder of Huma. Huma is one of the most recent UK-based health tech businesses valued at over $1 billion. And it was incredibly interesting to get his take on how to scale a digital healthcare business. And if you're really interested in that and some lessons learned, tough life lessons, I would check that one out. On to today's show, though, and we have another inspirational figure from the health tech world. It's actually a real honor to have Devika Wood on the show. So just as a quick summary, although we'll get into it on the show, although I'm not sure an hour is going to be long enough, Devika has had an incredible career being involved in Google, Babylon. She was the head of digital transformation, or head of digital strategy at AXA Health. She was an exited founder at Vida, which is an incredible story, which we'll get into. She has been the face of a UN campaign around women and women's inspirational figures, and actually ended up on a billboard in Times Square. And she herself has founded a network or an advocacy group for women in health, which is called Wealth. So it's a huge amount in there. She's widely regarded as one of the most inspirational figures in health, in healthcare, not just in the UK, but worldwide. And it's great to have you on the show. And she's currently founder, of Brain Plus, which is her new venture, which is probably what we're going to spend a large amount of our time talking about. I got a little bit starry-eyed there with the CV. So anyway, I'm glad I looked at my show notes. Devika, welcome to the show. How are you?
Good, thank you. Tired, but I mean, that was, listen, do you listen to yourself? You're just like, oh.
Yeah, it's a bit awkward, but it's all true. That's the great thing, right?
Yeah, that self-acceptance thing is like, I'm still on it. When I hear it, I'm like, that's who, what, me? I was like, yeah. My daughter, what?
How, speaking of your daughter, you've been up since 4 a.m., is that right?
Yeah.
Good times.
Oof, God, I'm so tired. I literally am just like, I just like becoming a mum. I'm just in this whole new world of like, how? I just feel like I've run a marathon before even opening my laptop. I've read hundreds of books. Like, I've had stickers stuck on me. I've had wee all over me. And then I'm like, right, let's write our half year report. I'm like,
Let's go to work.
what is
How old is your daughter?
2 years and 4 months.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
That is young.
that is young. Yeah, how old are yours?
I've got a 9-year-old, a 7-year-old, and a 4-year-old.
Jesus, three.
Yeah, three's an interesting thing.
Three's a joke.
Anyway, let's crack on. So, your career has been actually quite stellar, but had you always intended to go into health and technology, or what? How did you kind of get involved in this gig to begin with?
Yeah, so I've always, always, always wanted to be in healthcare, science, something related to helping people. Sounds cliche, but always had. I was called Dr. Toe when I was younger, when I was like a child, because I was obsessed with trying to heal my parents of their ailments, which is very bizarre. And then I fell into becoming a young carer for my nan when I was 10, and sort of, witnessed her getting dementia and all of the other atrocities that come with having dementia, and really falling into this like full-time care role as a young individual left such a marked impression on my life, and gave me this passion and impetus to try and change the way that healthcare was delivered because it was so instrumental to kind of my upbringing. And so I always wanted to be a doctor after that, but I ended up going into cancer research instead, decided that I did not like doing cancer research in the labs, and then magically got an opportunity to join Babylon when it was starting back in 2012. And that was kind of my first foray into the world of technology and completely transformed the way that I looked at healthcare and
I
tech.
and what was so Babylon's an interesting one, right? So for a while it was it well for a long time actually it was looking like it was crazily successful. I mean, like, incredibly successful. What was it like right back at the beginning?
Unbelievable. Do you know what? I was there when it was very much early stages and there was very little people around. So I think getting to work with somebody like Ali, on such a one-on-one basis was pretty inspirational for me, seeing how somebody's mind works that's actually really talented at what he does. I think people can have their theories and their views on Babylon as a whole and what they did and the kind of demise of it. But actually, when you look at the fundamental way that it, I suppose, changed the construct of how GPs could prescribe and do these remote GP calls, and thinking about the way that the kind of the AI triage tool was being developed, it changed the face of what we recognize as technology and the way that we can interface with healthcare professionals. So I think it had an amazing impact on the healthcare systems. And at the end of the day, people talk about the demise, but actually, people did experience big amounts of return, investors, prior to the demise and after the IPO, before the IPO. So I think it's been incredible from a journey perspective. But for me personally, getting to experience, talking to the CQC about changing the construct of how we can prescribe and how we can diagnose over a phone was one of the most incredible opportunities and experiences. And working with the people who were designing the interface of it. And I remember being in a boardroom and there was like a chalkboard and we were designing and kind of drawing out what the UX journey would look like. Unbelievable to think that I was part of such a small little thing that actually changed massively the landscape of healthcare.
Yeah, I think people, you can talk about what happened right at the end, right? But so we had, this was a while ago, but we had a guy called Chris Bischoff, who was the MD at General Catalyst, on the show. And he was the guy that backed Ali right back at the beginning with Babylon. And General Catalyst was one of their big VC backers. And I asked him the question. I was like, look, was the vision wrong, or was it the vision right and the execution ultimately was a little bit off in some ways? And he was like, no, the vision was absolutely correct, which I think is what you're saying, right?
Yeah, the vision was absolutely spot on. I think at the end of the day, if you can try to take out as much of the burden of seeing the GP in person, that administrative incumbent process of getting that 7-minute conversation to diagnose you and refer you in, that's the whole pretense around where Babylon started, right? Getting that appropriate intervention quickly when you needed it on the go without having to wait to get an appointment. I think that there is a whole kind of plethora of issues that come with thinking about that diagnosis journey embedding into the current construct of the NHS pathway and thinking about that diagnosis and then that onward referral. So once people were being diagnosed, getting them back into that appropriate referral. I think one of the things I noticed about the kind of GP primary care diagnostics piece was when I was working at AXA and we had a partnership with Doctor Care Anywhere. And the whole pretense around that was the fact that we wanted to get our members who had AXA insurance to be able to get accurately diagnosed quickly and then have diagnostics expedited through our insurance pathways. So they weren't waiting for ages. But what happened with that is that it became a kind of benefit to all of the members. People started using it as a sort of primary care interface, coming to use Doctor Care Anywhere as an interface for common coughs and colds, dermatological problems, eczemas, skin issues, MSK issues. These things shouldn't be put in through the primary care, especially if it's in an AXA or health insurance pathway, because those are the things that shouldn't be being sold for as part of our secondary care. So we started seeing this huge influx of primary care conditions that didn't need to be utilizing a GP's interface. And I think there was a similar issue that sort of, happened and manifested in the way that it didn't work when it became embedded into the NHS pathways itself. So I think there were so many things we can talk about. I don't know, but
No, I think that's super interesting. And so, how did you transition from Babylon into doing Vida?
so Vida was started when I was 26. I got an amazing opportunity to join an investment firm as an entrepreneur in residence. And I had been thinking about Vida for years and years since I'd obviously cared for my nan. I started obviously getting inspired when I was at Babylon around how we could use technology to change the interface of how care is delivered, and had this idea sort of spinning around in my head. When I got this opportunity to join as an entrepreneur in residence at a company or an investment firm called Hambro Perks, I started thinking about the idea. I was put together with a co-founder at the time, and they'd been sort of looking into the aged care sector. It was kind of the precipice or the kind of start of looking into the aged care sector. And we started to sort of design what it would look like from having a marketplace for matching carers to people living at home. We soon realized pretty quickly that having a marketplace was not going to solve the problem, which is getting appropriate care to the right place at the right time for people living in their own homes. And we had to become a regulated CQC entity.
To
And so then
provide, to actually be the ones that sort of facilitated the
deliver the
care.
care. Yeah, exactly. Facilitate and then deliver. So we got the CQC registration, we started to do all of that. And the next part we realized that was a fundamental flaw in the entire dom care sector is the logistics aspect. So you have this huge amount of carers, a massive care network that is going all over the country, shifts of 30 minutes, an hour, 15 minutes at a time for local authorities, managing them to go to their care visits, accurately tracking them between care visits to make sure they were turning up on time. That was logistics. The problem wasn't healthcare, it was logistics. So we ended up sincerely translating this entire value proposition into a logistics platform. And that was the next phase of Vida.
Okay, and like I saw a post from you, which is actually one of the images of you on the billboard in Times Square, and it was about the kind of level of exhaustion that you got to, with that kind of startup. Like, was that kind of positive exhaustion, or were you sort of beyond the point of the positivity around it? Like, how, because it can be exhausting, but it's still exciting, and you're getting something from it, or did it kind of tip over the tipping point towards the end?
Tipped over, fully tipped. I was done. My mental health was in absolute pots of despair.
Really?
It was hard. It was a journey and a half, Vida, and I've spoken about it because it is, it was a challenging first time founder story. A young female founder, 26 years old, had no idea about term sheets, equity, didn't understand the construct of it, and had a series of kind of really unfortunate events with being matched with a co-founder that was not great, not a good person. Not a pleasant story to say the least. And then translated to then sort of solo running the business and having to deal with a bunch of issues that translated after that from some just not very pleasant experiences and behavior from some of the shareholders that were small shareholders that kind of were friends with him. A bit of bullying that happened.
Oh
So
my gosh.
it was a catalyst for basically a breakdown, which happened.
Wow.
And the irony of that post around my face being in Times Square was that I was being recognized as this, formidable woman. She's now impossible to ignore. And on the outside, people must have been like, wow, she's so successful. The actual story was I was crying on a floor in Old Street with my mum because I was
Yeah.
going through an exit and, negotiating my terms. And, that's, I'm not alone in that. There are so many founders that go through that.
Yeah. I mean, not every founder gets their picture up in Times Square, but I take the point that you're trying to make about like everyone goes. The way I think about it is that even in a 12-hour day, the wheel just turns between success and failure.
100%.
Just like multiple times, even in 12 hours, and like to the point where you're like, I don't know what's coming next. I couldn't tell you. I don't know what is about to happen.
Nope, it's that roller coaster ride. And I think you have to be so resilient and you have to have such a strength of mind and character to be able to persevere through those changes in emotions and the dichotomy between an amazing win that happens 1 hour. And like you said, the next hour, it can be like, oh my God, we've got not enough money in the bank because an unexpected, thing has come in, or we've lost a massive contract. And that dichotomy, oh my goodness, people that go through it, you can understand it because you get this feeling of like utter elation to utter depression. And you have to pull yourself out of it really quickly and be like, right, what are we going to do?
Yeah,
It's
because
so
I've got to go
hard.
and speak to the, I've got to do a TV interview in like 2 minutes
Yeah.
and
And I
you've
feel
just
like a
dropped this on
fraud
me.
and a failure. And it's like you have to not get into that mindset because, God help me, it's hard.
Do you think that there's, because I there's almost no support about this mental issue, as far as I can tell. I mean, this isn't my first rodeo as far as the venture thing, but there isn't any support to founders, I don't believe, about what we're talking about here. I think you can learn about like people, you can go on a course to learn about, a term sheet, and you can go on a thing, you can do anything factual or objective. Have you ever come across any of this mental health support? Because I haven't seen it at all.
No, but if someone's developing it, bring it on.
Yeah. Or but do you feel like the venture capital or do investors have some kind of duty of care, even in the loosest sense?
100%. Oh my goodness, 100%. I think, do you know what I find, Matt? And like you said, you're not your first rodeo, it's not my first rodeo now, but I still find it crazy that you have this idea, and this idea is most of the time when you're working in healthcare, it's very mission driven, it's very purpose driven. You get up every day and you're like, I want to change the world because of X, Y, and Z, and it's in that fire bit in your belly, right? And you won't stop until you achieve it. And then you're given this amazing investment opportunity. You're given sometimes millions of pounds from investors who you then have to give the returns to for good reason because they've invested in you. And then there's this automatic thing where something's gone from an idea to having millions of pounds to then prove the value and the worth. And then you get into this cycle of like, oh my God, I'm now having to basically be responsible for X, Y, and Z. And I think it should 100% go hand in hand because the level of responsibility that you get overnight is unbelievable. It's and it needs to go together. And I think it would help so many people.
Yeah, I agree. I don't, I'm not sure quite, I don't quite know what I was expecting or what I expect, but there's almost no discussion I can see anywhere, even on LinkedIn most of the time, let alone in the boardrooms and with investors or about like founder mental health.
No. I see a few people talking about it. I think people are starting to be more vulnerable. I think there's still a fear that if people talk about their mental health struggles and they talk about it as a weakness, that they get scared that investors will see them as weak. And I
Oh,
have.
no, unfortunately, I totally think that that would happen,
Yeah.
unfortunately.
And I think that's the fear that people have, right? That's the absolute fear. And I think that's the thing we need to overcome because we are human and we're doing something that is lots of the time feels humanly impossible. And we need to give ourselves that space and honor that space to be able to do things protecting us as well.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, but I mean it, I don't know about it. I'm guessing the answer is no, given the kind of hints that you've dropped about Vida. But not that I don't, I don't need to be sort of patted on the head all the time, but I can't even remember the last time an investor asked me how I was doing. Do you know what I mean? They're like, they just assume it's like I was going really well, business is great, the headlines are amazing, congratulations. And they're like,
Are you
just
okay?
keep going. They're like, oh yeah, okay, yeah, cool.
Off you go
Yeah, great.
again. But I think that's why you need to have a community. You need to kind of get a village around you. And that's why these conversations and getting that community and that village and the ecosystem that you create yourself can change your life.
I totally agree. So we're going to go for our first commercial break now, and then after we come back, I want to switch into talking about what you're currently doing with Brain Plus, which I think is super exciting, and I'd love to understand the transition. And also, given how rough it sounds like your first rodeo was, like, how did you get your head in the right place to go again? Because no one would have thought twice if you said, "Look, do you know what? I'm now just going to take really senior, awesome roles in other people's companies."
Yeah.
So we will be back with my guest this week, Devika Wood, who's the CEO and founder of Brain Plus, and also a whole bunch of other really exciting things like Women in Health, which is called Wealth. We'll be back after this short break.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
If optimizing your health and well-being is on your to-do list, then let Revive Active, Ireland's number one super supplement brand, help you achieve that in the most convenient and comprehensive way possible. Clean, premium ingredients scientifically formulated to work in synergy to support immunity, energy, joints, heart health, sleep, emotional balance, and more. Benefit from the power, purity, and positivity of our award-winning powder sachets or our therapeutic capsule range. Use code RADIO15 at reviveactive.com and save 15% off today. Super supplements for a super you.
When you vacation with Norwegian Cruise Line, every day is a new day. Get a taste for Barcelona, then savor incredible dining options back on board one day. Connect to ancient history in Athens, and then disconnect completely in our spa another day. Wherever the sea breeze takes you, come aboard and experience a different tomorrow with NCL. Visit ncl.com, call your travel agent, or call 0333-336-1472. Norwegian Cruise Line, Ships Registry, the Bahamas and USA.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Hello, welcome back to this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost, and my amazing guest this week, Devika Wood. So, Devika, how did you, or what was the kind of motivation to transitioning across into the CEO role at Brain Plus?
So you touched on it before, but after Vida, I was like, that's it. I am done. I'm never doing it again. I was like, I never want to see another investor table. I don't want to see another pitch deck. I think I had a bit of PTSD, if I'm honest, because it was
I can well imagine by the sounds of it that you did.
Yeah. And being so young, I think 26, 29, you're so impressionable. And so I decided to go into corporate. That's when I went into AXA. And
Right.
I was like, I've got this. I'm going to go in and I'm going to change something. And God bless their souls. Amazing group of people I've worked with. I worked with the CEO, Tracy, and a bunch of amazing kind of board members trying to deploy this. And I learned a lot. I learned a lot actually around regulations, governance, and frameworks that actually I didn't know when I was doing startups. You don't know about the kind of process stuff. You just kind of go really scrappy. So I learned what I needed to learn. And by the end of the 2 years, I was like, okay, I miss it. I'm ready. I want to go back. So I got the opportunity to join another company called Orca and sort of scale them into the US. And I just started to get that bug again. I was like, I'm in. And then Brain Plus came along and oh my God, I fell in love with the product. I fell in love with what it does. And I was like, this is my calling. I'm back. It's
Oh,
Dementia.
cool.
Yeah. So I really, it's amazing.
So what to that point, what does it do? And what was the thing that really got you hooked?
So the thing that got me hooked, I'll start with there, was a product that's actually tangibly changing people's lives. So utilizing data to actually impact and change those living with dementia. And I'd never seen anything like it before. And having lived with my nan who had dementia, seeing kind of the awful chaos that experienced around, you know, over-medicating her with antipsychotic medication and a very little access to services that could support her from a quality of life perspective, I saw Brain Plus and CST, which is cognitive stimulation therapy, and I thought, my God, this is game changing. So CST is cognitive stimulation therapy. It's the world's leading non-drug intervention for dementia patients. It's as clinically effective, if not more, than drugs on the market. It delays cognitive decline by up to 6 months and more if you consistently do it. And the side effects, none. The only benefits are improved communication, a reduction in aggression, reduction in anxiety, an improvement in mood, and moments being made. And I thought, wow, we can actually change the way dementia care is delivered across the UK and the world by utilizing this. And that's what gave me that spark.
Okay, so just dial it back a second there. So what we're talking about here is because we're a broad church of listeners. So is it anyone with any kind of dementia, or are there certain it after certain stages, or before certain stages, or where is this sort of sitting?
Yeah, so mild to moderate dementia. So you get a diagnosis. CST is NICE recommended, so it's part of the NICE recommendations. So on the NHS, once you are diagnosed with dementia, you should be referred for CST. It's group therapy, so it's basically 5 to 8 people within a group setting with a trained CST facilitator. I can kind of refer to it as talking therapies for older adults. So that's kind of how you can think about it. When I first joined Brain Plus, we had a whole thing around let's go to the NHS, provide them with Isla, which is our sort of digital CST handbook that enables people to deliver CST at scale, really well standardized. The whole chaos happened with the NHS England demolished, commissioning structures all over the place. And actually, I thought, where are we best to deploy this? Where can we actually tangibly change people's lives? The care sector, the social care sector, there are people sat in care homes day in, day out that live with mild to moderate dementia and get really, really quickly on their journey to advanced dementia, quite significantly, like early on. This should be deployed as part of a standard framework for dementia delivery across care homes. No care home should not do this. It should be a given. So that's what we're doing. We're making sure that every care home embeds this as part of their framework to
And so
be.
the CST, is it like CBT in it, or on the same continuum as it, or is it sort of how does it actually work?
Yeah, so it's not, I suppose it's not the same. Well, all the CBTs and the CSTs and the kind of cognitive stimulation stuff all works in that same sort of framework, which is around, connecting your synapses, reminiscence, memories, putting you into the past, present, the future, thinking about your brain in a different way. But the way that CST actually works is activities. So it is clinically validated for activities. And I'll give you an example. So a CST trained facilitator will sit. There'll be a bunch of images on the screen. These images can pertain to childhood memories. It can pertain to the seasons. It can pertain to current affairs. The images will spark conversation. Each individual sat around that room will start to have a conversation based on prompts that the CST therapist will sort of say. Those prompts and those questions will start to embark people to go, I remember. They'll start to think about things they've never thought about. That conversation sparks moments, memories, and connections, and that's what it is.
And how's the clinical data? How have they assessed like it versus what's the standard of care? What's the alternative care pathway? You said it was
So
medication or no, or just leave it.
left. So you will have sort of on a standard pathway to diagnosis. If you get diagnosed with dementia, depending on how far along dementia you are, you might be given some kind of antipsychotic medications, behavioral medications, some memory medications that might help. But it really is medicalized at the moment. Obviously, CST is there as a non-medical intervention, but you have to kind of get it when it's mild to moderate because that's when it has the most effect. The way we assess the clinical benefits is we look at a bunch of different metrics, so quality of life, cognition improvement, mood, ability to communicate, how they feel, and we collect all that data to get the most amazing outcome reports that we then share with care homes to help them to see how their residents are improving.
And the NH, the, sorry, not the NHS, NICE, you said, has like approved CST as a concept.
As a CST, as a therapy, as a
As a
therapy
therapy.
intervention for people living with dementia.
Well, that's a huge step.
Huge, yeah. But we aren't the founders of CST. So
No.
CST is like a 20-year-old therapy.
It's like you can't be the founder of CBT. It
No,
just is a
exactly.
thing.
Exactly. Just clarify. I mean, I'd love to be. But Professor Amy Spector, who is the founder of CST, is an absolute legend. Just shout out to her. But obviously, we've developed Isla, which is a digital therapeutic that enables this CST to be delivered standardized and at scale, similar to how SilverCloud brought CBT into the digital age and all the other kind of digital interfaces for CBT. So that's what we're similar to. And the idea is obviously with any digital solution is that somebody should be able to grab this solution, this platform, this app, whatever it is, and be able to deliver something quickly, efficiently, at scale, and standardized and effective. And that's what our solution does.
And what's the reaction been like amongst, well, from the care home sector?
Unbelievable. So once you get to have a conversation with somebody on the front line, which in everyone who's worked in social care, it's like,
Not the easiest.
oh! But once we've had, been deploying and selling into some amazing homes, so we've done an amazing kind of got South Care homes, Majesticare, Park homes, we've got a bunch of different care homes that are using it. The biggest thing for me, where I feel like we're changing the world, is the activities coordinators. So those are the guys that are on the front line that are doing the activities for those living with dementia. Traditionally, the most underpaid, undertrained individuals. I don't know why, because they are doing one of the most important, valuable jobs in the care homes.
Absolutely.
Those people that are using it and being trained in CST feel like they now have a purpose. And not only that, they tangibly see the difference in people. They get the people saying, "I remember." They're seeing the improvement in their language. And the biggest thing, when they go into the common rooms away from the activities, the residents are having connections and conversations alone without any facilitation.
Oh,
That's
that's awesome.
that is the beauty of it.
That's
And
awesome.
yeah, that's where we can see we're truly making a difference.
And how, why, without, I mean, I'm not looking to like open up a huge can of worms, but you sort of alluded to it before. What is the, as far as an NHS is concerned, what are they doing in and of, in and around this mild to moderate dementia space currently? Which could be nothing, and it just sort of like the standard of care there is that these people are just being sort of left.
Yeah.
Or is
So
it just, or the decisions being just devolved to the care home that they happen to be in or something?
it's a challenging one. So essentially, when somebody's coming in and presenting with dementia symptoms, they will go to their GP. The GP normally will refer into a memory assessment clinic. In the memory assessment clinic, they are responsible for diagnosing, and then if they have commissioned CST, which I think is I think 70% of memory assessment clinics are commissioning CST, but only 30% are actively deploying it. They are meant to be responsible resource-wise to then deliver CST. Now, they do not have the resource to do it. So it doesn't make sense from a commissioning perspective to sit it in the memory assessment clinics. Usually in those clinics, they are getting more advanced dementias, and the more advanced dementias or the early younger onset dementias where they're having to deal with more complex issues. Mild to moderate shouldn't be sitting there. Mild to moderate should be sat being diagnosed by a GP, and the GP should then refer straight into CST because that's where you're capturing them quickly. The beauty of this is there are a number of GP practices that are signed up to what is the dementia-led strategy, which means that the GP practitioners or practice managers or practice leads can actually diagnose dementia as long as it's kind of a non-complex dementia. So what we're now doing is working with a PCN to try and deploy CST and change the commissioning structure of where CST should sit. And alongside that, obviously work within the care home sector. So that's what we're trying to do and change. But it's, as you know, working with the NHS, it's so complex and it's a long-term game plan.
Well, and also like I get, I'm not obviously not an expert in the sector at all, but it strikes me that there's so much complexity in this particular area around the needs and the individuals and the funding and the social care sector and elderly care and it's a really complex sort of commissioning landscape, delivery landscape. So it must be really difficult to try and figure out how to navigate and make changes and push for changes.
Yeah, it's quite chaotic. It's sad because actually when you look at the stats and the data, so dementia is the leading cause of death in women in the UK. By 2050, one in three people will be living with dementia. So it's going up there with the C word now, which is devastating. But the problem with dementia is that it is, probably the least funded, the least amount of services or solutions available, the least amount of medication available. So one of the things I always say is that if you can't solve the problem where it's happening. So in the NHS, why don't we solve the problem where we think we can solve it and make the biggest impact? And that's why we realized the care home sector, we could truly transform the landscape of effective dementia care while simultaneously trying to work on the NHS and changing the landscape of commissioning. But like, you know, one thing's going to be a long-term plan. You have to have the revenue coming in from another side. But
You
in
do.
healthcare, the revenue has to also be making a difference. So we realized we could do the two-pronged approach.
That makes total sense. How much of this, and then the answer might be zero, by the way, but how much of this, the CST kind of approach, therapy approach, overlaps with the world of social prescribing? So it strikes me that there might be some overlap there around like non-traditional, non-medicated routes to deliver additional care in a social setting.
Yeah, so I think there's a huge overlap with social prescribing when it comes to kind of CST. I think that the way that we've started to envisage it is a really kind of utilizing the community-based assets that exist, which especially in social care is so important. So, you know, thinking about care homes, community assets like cafes, memory clinics, dementia cafes, CST should be widely available in some form or another to those living with dementia. I think the other aspect of it, which I think is really important, is that we have such a high amount of informal carers now working to support
Yeah.
their loved
How
ones
many
that
do you,
being
what's the
diagnosed.
latest estimate, do you reckon?
I think there's something like 60% of individuals who are working and actively giving back to the economy from a work perspective are informal carers at the same time. The numbers of kind
Wow.
of impact on the economy is in the billions for the informal care sector.
Wow.
Astronomical. It's huge. And
That's
it makes sense, right?
yeah.
Because
That's amazing.
if it's one of the leading causes of death in women and it's got such a high incidence rate, there is going to be an absolute burden on those that are working to be informal carers. And I was one, right? So I know. And my family were. So I think that there needs to be a higher impetus around how we can actually support informal carers to better support their loved ones living with dementia. Since I've joined Brain Plus, I cannot tell you the amount of individuals that have messaged me who have just had a family member diagnosed, a mum, a dad, an auntie, an uncle, and they are lost. They literally have no idea what to do. And they're saying to me, can I use CST? I don't know how to speak to my mum anymore.
Right.
And this is where we can start to really make a change as well. How about upskilling and supporting those in the informal care sector to be able to communicate with their loved ones
Yeah, do
effectively?
you like is it your vision where you could sort of we've done this at PocDoc with the Healthy Heart Check, sort of upskilled individuals in and around the community space to be able to deliver healthy heart checks, if that makes sense? Is
Oh,
that
yeah.
part of the vision about what you guys are trying to do to sort of upskill community individuals or any individual, it could be an informal carer, to be able to offer CST?
Yeah, I think what you guys have done is literally the best way forward. I have so much respect for that because I don't think we utilize our community assets in the best way at all when it comes to healthcare. And I think that what you've done in terms of kind of the assets around pharmacies and making it widely available just makes so total sense. Make things quick, make it accessible, make it easy so that we can get things done quicker, right?
Yeah.
For us and for me personally and our team, it's about making sure that those on the front line are trained in CST so that they can deliver CST effectively across the care settings, whether it's care homes. In the dom care space, we want to start basically supporting care homes to open up their groups, their CST groups that they're delivering to people who are in the community still living at home to join the care home groups.
That's a great idea.
It's
Do they
so
do
good.
that? Do they don't do that right now? That's a
No,
great
they
idea.
don't. And I think it's a community asset, right? Like, would
Yeah,
you
it's an anchor.
expect?
It's an anchor institution. Everyone knows where the care home is in their village or town.
Exactly. And that some of the assets, I mean, some of the care homes I've seen are so amazing. The people working in them are so inspired to make a change and they're set up for it. They're set up to welcome these people into their homes. So for us, that's like our next point of call. And that means that we can then get as much kind of demand and supply matching. So it becomes an almost marketplace for getting people access to CST. And then we go that one step further, which is empowering the informal care sector and really helping those that are looking after their loved ones to be empowered to understand what CST is, have the awareness around
Yeah,
CST.
I mean, I think it's almost like about knowing it's there so you can have a conversation with your GP or at the memory access clinic or the
Exactly.
whatever it happens to be. Like if you don't, I mean, before I started to do my show research, I had no idea what it was. No, and I mean, No idea at all. So there must be lots of people out there that don't know and don't know enough to kind of ask about it. So what I
Exactly.
was we were in Cornwall with the kids in the summer a couple of weeks ago, and we went to the there was a mining museum because where we were they did a lot of clay mining back in the day, and they've created a museum around the mine, but then the cafe, which is really nice, is a big social prescribing hub. So you go in and you go to the reception, you get your tickets, and there's all the leaflets, the other stuff you can do and around. And then they've got the cafe, and there's this big blackboard around. So it says social prescribing schedule. So it's all very open and public. And like, you know, it's one of those anchor institutions because it was a mining village for hundreds of years. And so now they're using that anchor institution. It's not, obviously, it's not a care home, but I completely agree that community assets are underused in many cases.
Yeah, couldn't have said it better myself. I think you've got it spot on, and it's exactly why when you think about deploying, getting as much market penetration as possible with a solution, you've got to think about community first. How can you meet the people where they are? And that's exactly what you're doing. It's what we're doing, because you can't always meet the people where they are in the NHS, right? You're going to be meeting them when they're in their healthcare journey. Sometimes it's too late. Sometimes it's really difficult to get in there. So meet them where they are, where they feel comfortable. Get them engaged. Get that awareness going. I am such an advocate for it.
I completely agree. Right. We're going to go for our last commercial break. Thank you for listening. We will be right back with the last part of today's show with the inspirational Devika Wood. We'll be right back.
UK House Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Apples and pears, beef and skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, ant and deck, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com.
Strawberries and cream. A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
The station that makes you feel good.
Hello, and welcome back to this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost, and my guest, Devika Wood. We are into the final part of the show, Devika. So, what I would love to talk about with you right now is how do you view the next kind of 2 to 5 years around dementia care? Because like you said in the beginning bit, the numbers and the statistics are kind of, well, not just kind of scary, they're absolutely terrifying in terms of the progression. I was just underselling it there. They're absolutely terrifying. I mean, there's a lot of statistics in health that aren't great, but dementia particularly. Is CST, is one of a continuum of things? I mean, you also mentioned that there's not that many drugs seemingly available or being developed, or like how much do you feel like the industry, quote unquote, is not focusing on dementia, for example?
Yeah, so I think there is a bit of an issue around dementia from a personal perspective in terms of kind of the way the NHS strategy came out, their 10-year plan. You know, there was
it in there? I can't remember
well,
seeing
it was, but it wasn't I don't think it was good enough. Go and get people coming for me now.
What did it say?
I don't think it was good enough. I mean, for starters, they took out the operational targets for effectively getting diagnosed quickly and within an appropriate time frame, which I think is terrible. It's one of the worst things.
Hold on. So there's now no waiting list target, for example.
No, there's no target to get diagnosed. There was an operational target that was taken out, which I don't understand.
Wow. But has it got taken out the plan, or it's actually been taken out of frontline care?
Like taken out. There is no operational target for getting diagnosed within a certain time frame.
Wow.
And I don't understand that because when you look at all of the issues we've talked about, there are people are waiting to be diagnosed for up to a year. When they are getting diagnosed, they're not being signposted effectively. There are no drugs that are being commissioned.
Well,
So
and also, sorry, just to jump in, but is it true? This might not be true because in some pathways, not just, I mean, in general, in any kind of disease pathway, not dementia specifically, but until you have been diagnosed, you have a restricted level of access to certain care, right? So until you have that diagnosis, you can't access certain things.
No. So, like, especially in social care, because the diagnosis basically hinges on you being able to kind of get social care funding or carers allowance if you can get carers allowance. Obviously, there are other aspects around you might need a carer for, basic support needs and whether the amount of money in your bank account and your funding situation enables you to get social care benefits for it. But getting diagnosed with dementia is absolutely critical to help you then signpost to the most effective treatment solutions. But obviously, then we've seen the same information coming out in the headlines around decanemab and Leqembi not being commissioned on the NHS.
Sorry, what are they? Are they two key drugs?
Two key drugs that were being researched heavily and shown to be kind of clinically effective. I mean, spoiler alert, CST has the same clinical effectiveness as both those drugs. So just putting that one out there.
But is that part of the reason why they didn't get through? Not, presumably, they didn't get through NICE assessment, right?
Yeah, but the problem was the reason why they weren't approved was because the clinical effectiveness versus the cost effectiveness wasn't high enough, essentially.
Right.
So they were only really relevant for a very small population. I think it's like 70,000 individuals would be relevant for the dacanumab and Leqembi. So it
Okay.
meant that the kind of clinical effectiveness versus the cost effectiveness wasn't there.
Sure.
And then obviously on top of that, the lack of signposting to effective solutions doesn't exist. So there is so much that's worrying. I think for my dream situation state to happen, I think there needs to be a frontline availability, strategic implementation for CST to be that first point of call, diagnostic wise. I mean, to get diagnosed quickly, you need to then get access to it. I think there's a huge issue now with diagnostics. We're not getting diagnosed quickly enough, and how we can kind of move towards that is a huge part.
What's the gold standard diagnostic for dementia?
So it's a standard sort of kind of assessment framework that
Okay.
the GP or a clinician will go through.
Okay.
A number of different questions they go through, kind of cognitive function and testing awareness and skills. But there are now new kind of biomarkers coming out. There are new sort of methodologies around testing bloods and hormone levels.
Okay.
And more accurate diagnostic testings around the surveys that are being carried out. I think there's so much that will happen quite quickly, but I think the awareness piece needs to come out much faster around the impetus and the importance of dementia. I still don't think that's really on a high list for some reason.
So, my very good friend Vix, who sometimes listens to this podcast, so Vix, if you're listening, you're an absolute legend. She went through something similar with her mum around trying to get a diagnosis in this space, and it was very, very difficult. And she and her sister did an incredible job. But it's that the requirement of a diagnosis to access care is a massive bottleneck, right? And so. In not just in dementia, actually, in tons of cancer, all kinds of different things, right? But a lot of those pathways have requirements or at least targets to hit. So now there are no targets.
There's no targets, and the problem is that people, the biggest bottleneck at the moment is getting diagnosed quickly enough. I think that they're moving towards a better place around the GPs being able to diagnose, and obviously part of that dementia-led strategy. If a primary care network is signed up to the dementia-led strategy, they get funding or money every time they diagnose an individual with dementia, which is brilliant because I think it should be put onto the GP at the front line because at the end of the day, they're the ones that are seeing people coming
Well,
through.
I would have, aren't they seeing almost 100% of these early diagnosis
Yeah,
cases anyway, right?
100%.
Well, I mean,
100% of
where
them.
else are people going?
No,
An A&E,
exactly.
I guess, right?
Yeah, exactly. So it's like they should be empowered and enabled to do this. It's one of the things I think the GP should be doing. And they are given the impetus to do it now. But I think that then, there needs to be a quicker way and a better way of understanding symptoms. And from the point that you start seeing symptoms, how can you then get a measured response to be diagnosed quicker? I think that's a bit of the missing link at the moment. And biomarkers and things like that will play a huge part in enabling that to happen.
And how advanced is the blood biomarker science at this point?
So I think there's a lot of research being done. Alzheimer's Society are really key and pivotal in leading this research. I think that it traditionally and historically we have been very underrepresented in clinical research studies. So I think I was listening to their chief scientific officer speaking at an event, and she was saying that I think last year or the year before there was only 60 individuals that showed up for a clinical study that was part of this biomarker research. And so the lack of kind of individuals putting themselves into clinical studies is huge.
Recruitment, right? Recruitment's a
Exactly.
massive issue.
Huge bottleneck. So there's that part of it being played. So I think that we're probably still a while off, but I think it is getting better because there is an improved awareness around symptoms and an improved awareness around understanding what people need to do once they start seeing the symptoms, especially from a family perspective.
And I mean, again, I'm not an expert, so my only conclusion around the blood-based biomarker space is if dementia is a catch-all term for lots of different things, and actually like that would make it more difficult to come up with a biomarker or biomarkers. But actually, if there is a set that is almost consistent, like for example, I think Alzheimer's is like around the plaques, right? Like so there might be something around plaque formation or something. I don't know, then that might make it easier to
Yeah,
figure out.
there's kind of a lot more research being done around how it's forming. There's so much studies, and I pray for there to be more studies around this, but obviously there's a lot of issues around now women presenting with what they believe to be menopause, thinking it's dementia because it's brain fog and it has the same symptoms as dementia.
Ooh.
So there's a huge issue now perpetuating in that space.
Really?
Yeah,
So
so there's
hold
a
on. So
shift
hold on. Let's
there.
quickly, because I'm kind of annoyed. We only got to that with like 8 minutes left. That sounds like a huge topic. So women are presenting at GP or some frontline care with brain fog, and those are the symptoms that could either be menopause or early stage dementia. Is that
Dementia.
correct?
Yeah, exactly. So they're not misdiagnosing, but people are believing they've got dementia because they're seeing symptoms and signs of brain fog. So they're believing it to be early stages of dementia. And I've heard so many stories, so many people that are now in the space who are actively trying to research, is it early onset dementia? Is it actually a kind of a prelude to getting dementia because you're seeing the brain fog? Is it the same? Is the brain fog associated with the tau and the plaques that are forming around your neurons and your synapses? It is the most
Wow.
under-researched, untapped area, because then it goes into the whole women's health conversation, which we now have own
Yeah.
how
But do you, how much of that do you believe is dragged into the sort of not enough investment in women's health versus investment in overall health kind of debate, which I think is sort of what you're alluding to?
Yeah, I think I think it's huge. There is, unfortunately, and I don't like to, I really don't like to go towards this the bias conversation, but I think it needs to happen. Is that, if dementia is affecting one in three women, sorry, not dementia is the leading cause of death for women, and it's one in three people are going to have dementia. Dementia also affects like disproportionately women because they are carers. The care network and the carers are women. Menopause are highly obviously women. Unless you're seeing the same impact around brain fog and symptoms, then there is definitely something going on here around an undertapped area that is not being researched enough because the narrative is around women.
What is your quick te and again, I don't have the statistics in front of me, so I don't know, but do you think th is it that there's not enough investment going into things around specifically women's health, or is there something around like is that bias? Is that discrimination? Is that historical? Because up until the 80s or 90s, we weren't even using women in clinical studies or whatever bonkers statistic that when I found that out for the first time, I completely blew my mind. But what is it? What's your take on that issue?
So basically, everything you said, we haven't been involved in clinical trials enough, drug trials, even the fact that car seat belts weren't even designed for women, hilarious. Can't get my head around it.
No.
Studies around ovarian aging, around menopause, have literally only started to happen in the most recent sort of 5 to 6 years, really, if you look at the clinical studies. And when you think about the investment statistics, 2% of funding goes to, what is it, female founders, and I think
Yeah.
it's even less for women's health. And everyone talks about the narrative. So you're trying to pitch to investors who are predominantly men. Men don't understand as much women's health issues or problems because they can't relate to it. I don't know if it's necessarily that. I just think it's because And it probably has something to do with that, but I think health in general is still one of the most untapped, underinvested areas in comparison to when you look at the other areas like fintech, like I don't know, or prop tech, all the other kind of areas that are a bit more snazzy that give bigger returns, because healthcare is so complex and we can never kind of overcome the complexities of it. But I think that women's health is disproportionately 100% invested in, supported, pushed through because of all of the variables and the factors that we've just
So
mentioned.
let's just take this issue of where dementia overlaps with menopause, right? So, and this is obviously much, much more broader than the like 3 minutes that we've got left, so I apologize. But is that a health issue or a women's health issue, or like what? Because it's dementia, right, which affects one in three people, and some of those one in three people will be women. Like how does that get kind of split up, do you think, like in terms of, because that is an investment thesis, is a dementia thesis, or is it like a women's health thesis? That I don't know, it's weird, right?
So interesting you said that. So I pitched to an investor, like a female syndicate investment group about Isla and Brain Plus,
Okay.
and they told me that I should make it specifically a women's health issue because it should be framed as that in order to get the investment that I needed from them. So 100%, I think you could class it as a women's health issue because it predominantly disproportionately impacts women. However, dementia is a disease that affects everyone,
All
right?
of
It's
us.
going to be one in three, it's all of us. So I don't want to be, to be honest, I don't want to put it into a bucket that is only going to be for women because it is such a massive disease that needs to be focused for everyone. But can we look at creating diagnostics? Can we look at creating solutions and services that can support women who experience dementia? Because it's going to be different to how a man experiences dementia. Yes, that is where I fundamentally think we can make a change. But I will be solving this for everyone and we'll always look at it as a worldwide
Makes
problem.
total sense. We've got 1 minute left, or 1.5 minutes left. So in that time, in this time, I always ask the guests to just, if you've got a motto or a mantra that you kept on referring to get you through those difficult times that you want to pass on to the listenership, what would that be?
Oh, what's my motto or mantra? I think it's probably this too will pass has been my biggest go-to. But now my kind of reason to be and reason to get through is just I look at my daughter, I look at a picture of her, and it
Oh.
literally gets me through the hardest times ever.
Oh, that's really sweet. On that note, Devika, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you. You've been amazing. Thank you for
And
having me.
thank you for everyone for listening. We'll be back again next week with another show.